Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Everyone, I'd like to welcome all of you to the ISO 9001:2015, Knowing What to Expect to Ensure a Stress-Free Audit Presentation. My name is Joseph Krolikowski. I am the QMS Program Manager for Perry Johnson Registrars. Our topics for today, I've got some opening comments on ISO 9001 and how it is an interpretive document. We'll discuss briefly how this presentation was put together, how we mined data and tried to put something together that was comprehensive. We're going to go over some key areas within the standard itself and a couple of additional key areas after we're finished here. I've got them listed. We'll discuss leadership's role both in the quality system and in the audit process, a couple concluding remarks, and then your questions. So for our presentation today, it's important to remember that ISO 9001 is an interpretive document. When ISO 9001:2015 was published, it was actually the first version of ISO 9001 to have explanatory content written right into the standard itself. And since it was published, it's actually one of the only ISO published standards to have a whole separate supplemental standard, which I'll be giving you some information on in the next slide here. About a year after ISO 9001:2015 was published, the ISO published TS 9002. Now, we'll be referring to this document in a few places as just ISO 9002. Its full title is Quality Management Systems Guidelines for the Application of ISO 9001:2015. So this is an officially sanctioned guidance document, and it provides clause-by-clause ideas on fulfilling the requirements. Now, if we've got anybody on the call today that remembers the original 2000 version of ISO 9004. This is similar to that. It is, as I said, a clause-by-clause guidance on implementing ISO 9001. Very unique document. So having all of this guidance, having all of these tools for interpreting the standard, obviously, we have to recognize that ISO 9001 is intended to be interpreted. And there are going to be different interpretations. And it's also important to recognize that none of the requirements from ISO 9001:2015 has a perfect method for implementation. That's critical. Each individual organization, each individual process owner, they have to determine a methodology for implementing the requirements. The role of the auditor in this case, then, is to review what the organization has done and exercise their judgment as to whether or not the methodology truly meets the requirement of the standard. So users of the standard are interpreting it, auditors are interpreting it, certification bodies are interpreting it, and even the writers of the standard are interpreting it. Now, one of the more interesting changes in the 2015 revision of ISO 9001 was the elimination of required procedures. Personally worked with ISO 9001 long enough that my first version of the standard was the 1994 version. And at that time, there were 16 required procedures. You had to have a procedure for document control. You had to have a procedure for non-conforming product control. You had to have a procedure for what they called process control, and so forth. When we transitioned to the 2000 version of ISO 9001, and then carrying on with the 2008 version, that list was truncated. It was reduced to 6 required procedures. Now, in the 2015 revision of ISO 9001, even that has been eliminated. There are no required procedures. Now, procedures, you must understand, are one way to control a process or an activity within a ISO 9001 quality management system. They're not mandatory, but if the organization chooses to have a procedure, chooses to have a work instruction for anything, it doesn't even have to be something necessarily that has a specific line item within ISO 9001. The content of that procedure can be cited in the context of an audit. And we can do that based on how the term audit criteria is defined. And this definition is taken from the ISO 9000 Fundamentals and Vocabulary document. Criteria is defined as policies, procedures, or requirements used as reference against which objective evidence is compared. So if you, for example, have a procedure for management review, and you say that you're going to have a management review meeting every month, well, the standard doesn't require that, but your procedure does. And if you're not meeting that procedure, the auditor can issue an infraction for that violation of procedural content. Now, unbelievably, ISO 9001 2015 has been in print. We're going up on 6 years now. And the ISO 9001 standard itself has been around for over 30 years. You would think after that much time that some of these items would eventually be known and there'd be fewer nonconformances written in certain areas. But year over year, we see the same things being written for new companies and even for legacy companies that have been certified for a long time. So back in October 2018, we did a data mining exercise, and we pulled about 350 audits from a period of time covering roughly the prior 12 months. And we went through, and any audits where there were nonconformances written, we started tabulating, and we came up with a top 5 in terms of the issues that were cited the most often. So I've got them listed here. Management review at the top, internal audit, quality objectives, what a lot of folks call calibration or verification of monitoring and measuring resources, and external provider approvals. Now, interestingly, 3 of these are all legacy requirements that go all the way back to the first version of ISO 9001 that was published in 1987. Now, recognizing that we cannot advocate specific methodologies for implementing anything from ISO 9001 2015, what we felt we could do was try to provide some clarity on what these requirements are commonly interpreted to mean and how they are commonly fulfilled. So what we're going to be doing over the next several slides, this should not be taken as an official PJR endorsement of approach, and it certainly cannot be used as justification for any circumstance cited by an auditor within an official nonconformance. We will be giving some details on how to file a dispute a little bit later in our presentation today. So let's begin with management review, the most often cited item for a nonconformance. Management review is written into section 9.3, and there are 3 subclauses. We're going to refer to these as parts. Now, part 1 of the requirement says that top management shall review the quality management system at planned intervals to ensure continued suitability, adequacy, effectiveness, and alignment with strategic direction. Now, the key portion here is planned intervals. What this means is that you have to have some manner of controlling the frequency and content of the management review meetings. Now, this could be a number of things. You could have an internal schedule. You could have a procedure for this. You could have automated reminders. But you need to be prepared to demonstrate to your auditor how you have met this requirement of planned intervals, how this has been achieved. Part two of the requirement goes on to read that the management review meeting shall be carried out, taking into consideration. And then there's a long list of topics here, internal, external issues, customer satisfaction, corrective actions, audit results, resource adequacy, opportunities for improvement. Now, each of these content items is mandatory, but it's not a requirement that every item be included in every management review. In other words, if you want to have more frequent meetings, but take just a few things at a time, that's fine. As long as it doesn't violate an internal requirement or something, say, from a customer of yours or something else that's binding, you can absolutely take the management review in smaller, shorter bites. A lot of our clients like to use a PowerPoint presentation to show what they've discussed. Not mandatory, but certainly a good idea. A lot of organizations will use a standardized agenda format to make sure that nothing is missed. Again, great idea, but not mandatory. The last part of the management review requirement talks about that the outputs of management review shall include decisions and actions. And then they highlight that this needs to lead to opportunities for improvement, changes to the system, and resource needs. Now, it's important to remember, think of it this way. Management review is supposed to be productive. I've highlighted decisions and actions here. This should not just be a churn of information. You know, we mentioned PowerPoint slides on the previous page of our presentation here. You know, if you show us a series of PowerPoints, well, here's our management review. That's great. It shows us that you've covered required topics for discussion, but it may not hit the mark in terms of showing us what the decisions and actions were. You got to bear that in mind, that there's outputs to consider as well. Lastly, the organization is required to retain documented information as evidence of the results of management review. These things need to be on the record. Anytime you see a retained documented information statement, that means on the record. So that's management review. Our second key focus item that we're going to discuss is internal audit. Now, internal audit is found in section 9.2 of the standard, and there are two subclauses. In part one, it indicates that the organization needs to conduct audits at planned intervals. There's that verbiage again, to provide information on whether the quality management system conforms to the organization's requirements for its quality management system, as well as the requirements of this international standard. In other words, ISO 9001 itself. And also, is the quality management system effectively implemented and maintained? Now, again, the key point here, the first one is planned intervals. You do have to have some kind of scheduling mechanism. And again, it's at your discretion, whether this be calendar triggers, audit plans, database scheduling, or some combination therein. It's up to you, but you have to have something. Again, you're absolutely allowed to do big audits, small audits, and so forth. You can definitely do the audit in small bites if that's what you wish to do. Now, I highlighted this idea of the requirements of the international standard. You know, making sure that all of the requirements are included in the internal audit process. Now, one mistake that's made here from time to time is not including the internal audit process itself in the internal audit assessment. So, be advised, you are required to audit the audit, so to speak. Internal auditing is part of the standard, therefore itself has to be included in the internal audit process. And I know that's not perfect grammar. Sorry about that. Now, I also like to point out the fact that the audit is to be conducted against the quality management system. This is key. Remember that ISO 9001 itself establishes that a quality management system is made up of processes. And this is established in section 441, where it says that the organization needs to determine the processes needed for the quality management system and their application throughout the organization. So therefore, the expectation is that you should structure your internal audits with respect to your processes and not necessarily the clauses from the standard itself. Audit your processes. That's the expectation. The second part of the internal audit requirement, a couple of things that are in play here. You need to plan your audit program in a particular fashion. You need to define scope and criteria. You need to ensure that auditors are objective and impartial. You need to make sure that results of the audit are reported to management. You need to take appropriate correction and corrective action without undue delay. And again, you need to have audits that are on the record, retained documented information. So let's look at some key focus items here. Talking about auditor competency, ISO 9001:2015 has no minimum requirements for auditor competency. Just like everything else that's done within your quality management system, the expectation is that you will decide for yourself what it means to be competent. You know, you think about the fact that you've defined competency for every other requirement within your system. So it's no different for internal auditing. And it's important that your internal auditor qualification records not just be a training sign-off. You know, you do have to determine competency requirements. That's established in section 7.2. Now, a key issue that does come up from time to time is lack of responsiveness to internal audit nonconformances. Now, internal audit nonconformances should be treated with the same seriousness that is taken with PJR nonconformances or customer complaints. The requirements, as we've specified, they specifically mention both correction and corrective action in this context. So again, we expect that you are going to respond to internal audit nonconformances and take care of those internal audit nonconformances. And then obviously you need to retain records of the internal audit process at large. And there's a lot of ways that this can be done. You know, checklists, procedural printouts, you know, whatever the tools are going to be, that's at your discretion. But bear in mind, these need to be sufficiently detailed to give us confidence that you looked at your entire quality management system. And bear in mind, that should include recording evidence of conformity in addition to evidence of nonconformity. In other words, a stack of nonconformances unto themselves, that does not provide complete evidence of an internal audit program. The nonconformances are not the be-all, end-all to show us that you've done an internal audit. Bear that in mind. Okay, want to make a very important key point on consultants. A lot of our clients choose to outsource their internal audit program to a consultant, and that's perfectly fine. But you must remember that regardless of who did the audit, the responsibility for the audit program is yours. This is your quality management system, not your consultants. It's your quality management system. So you should be able to speak confidently about the internal audit process and how it is controlled. Bear that in mind. Okay, our third key focus item is quality objectives. And this requirement is found in section 6.2. So let's take a closer look at this now. 6.2 starts out by saying that you need to have quality objectives at relevant functions, levels, and processes. These objectives need to fill several criteria that I've got highlighted here. The key items are that they be measurable, relevant to conformity of products and services, and to the enhancement of satisfaction of customers, and be monitored, communicated, and updated. So let's take these one at a time here. First of all, this idea that they have to be measurable. In other words, you need to know whether or not the objective was met. You know, it cannot be something that is just vague that you can't measure. Now, the most common objectives are going to be variable measurements, you know, things like a rate of on-time delivery or a rate of scrap or things of that nature. But we do from time to time have what I refer to as attribute type objectives. You might think of them like pass-fail objectives. And this could be, for example, something like we want to achieve NADCAP accreditation by December 2022 or something like that. Well, that's something either you make it or you don't. So that would be an attribute type objective. The standard requires that your quality objectives be relevant to customer satisfaction and products and services. This was actually a new requirement back when ISO 9001 2015 was published. Now, it's important for us to note that objectives that are rooted in things like profitability or safety, these are not forbidden, but the organization needs to ensure that if you have those types of objectives, that you've also got other objectives that get closer to the heart of customer satisfaction and product service conformity. So bear that in mind. Quality objectives are a topic that everybody in a system, in a quality management system, is expected to be aware of. Now, you don't have to have these things memorized. But you know, when I teach new auditors, I always tell them, this is something that you can ask anybody about. Are you familiar with the quality objectives? Which one is relevant to you? So, you know, as an organization, there's a lot of ways that you can accomplish this. You know, placards, meetings, cards that you hand out. None of that is mandatory, but everybody in the organization needs to be aware of these items. They need to be prepared to speak about these items. The second part of the quality objectives requirement says that the organization needs to determine what will be done, the resources required, who's responsible, et cetera. And I like to point out from ISO 9002, there's a clarification on what they mean by what will be done. And that is that the organization should determine the actions that need to be implemented to achieve its quality objectives. So this is the organization as a whole taking action. Objectives are not supposed to be passive, well, let's set this objective and hope we get there. This is supposed to be something that you're very actively engaged in and working to accomplish. Now, the key takeaway from part two, obviously, is that it's not enough to just have the objectives. You need to be tracking progress towards those objectives. And you need to take action to improve objectives. You know, we have this once in a while. Again, when I'm teaching new auditors, I have this discussion from time to time. Am I supposed to issue a nonconformance if an organization fails to meet one or more of their quality objectives? Well, the answer to that is not necessarily. Failing to meet an objective in and of itself is not a nonconformance. Failing to meet an objective and doing nothing about it, that's an issue. And that's potentially going to be grounds for a nonconformance. And you'll note the verbiage here. The verbiage is necessary action. Now that means an appropriate response. It may not necessarily mean formal corrective action. So again, bear that in mind also. Let's turn our attention to monitoring and measuring resources. Now, I suspect for a number of you on our call today, you may refer to this requirement simply as calibration. That was how I was brought up as a new auditor to understand this requirement, even though we may have one or two technical folks on the call that say it isn't always calibration, and I agree with you. Talking about monitoring and measuring resources, this is going to be any device, tool, gauge, meter, scale, or similar item that's used to perform monitoring and measuring of outputs. This is most typically referred to as inspection or testing. Our primary clause here is section 715, which in turn has two subclauses. So let's take a look at those. The first part of the requirement states that the organization needs to determine and provide the resources that are needed for valid measurement results. You need to ensure that these are specific and suitable for the types of measuring and monitoring that you're going to be doing, that they're fit for purpose. And then you shall retain appropriate documented evidence as to the evidence of fitness for purpose of the monitoring and measurement resources. Now, the primary requirement is the last one, obviously, where it talks about retained documented information demonstrating fitness for use. For most of the organizations that implement ISO 9001, this is going to be the calibration or verification records for all measurement devices. Now, the content of those records is going to be influenced by the second part of the requirement. So let's take a look at part two here. Goes on to say that the organization shall ensure that measuring equipment is the following. And the key stuff here is these three middle bullets, that it be calibrated or verified or both at specified intervals or prior to use against measurement standards traceable to international or national measurement standards. Measuring equipment shall also be identified in order to determine status and safeguarded from adjustments, damage, or deterioration. So the two most often violated aspects of what we just looked at. First of all, this business of required traceability to national or international standards. Your measurement devices need to be traceable to a national standard or an international standard. Now, here in the United States, that's going to be the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST. Now, in those rare circumstances where an NIST traceable method is not available, typically it's going to be acceptable for calibration to be performed by the original device manufacturer. This is part of what we're looking for when we look at the calibration certificates. Is there traceability to the NIST code? We want to see those code numbers written into the calibration records. Also, consistent and reliable device identification in order to determine status. Now, this means that the device itself is identified to determine status. It does not necessarily mean calibration stickers. I think we still have a couple of old school auditors out there that occasionally will say that you're supposed to have calibration stickers. Calibration stickers are great, but they're not mandatory. What's required is that the device have some form of identification in order to determine the calibration status. Now, what that identification is, what it consists of, that can vary, and it's at your discretion as an organization. Okay, our fifth key focus area, external provider approvals. Now, if you read the older versions of ISO 9001, the following terms were used. Now, some of you may still be using this terminology in your company, and that's perfectly fine. Suppliers, subcontractors, outside partners. Now, in some of the older versions of ISO 9001, the requirements that were associated with those parties, they resided in separate parts of the standard. Now, in the 2015 version, we applied the term external provider, and it was meant to be a collective term. The requirement to approve those parties, though, this is not a new idea. And currently, we look to the third paragraph of clause 8.4.1 for our applicable verbiage here. So here's how that reads. You shall determine and apply criteria for the evaluation, selection, monitoring of performance, and re-evaluation of external providers. And you shall retain documented information of those activities. So basically, as an organization, it's up to you to establish a methodology for external provider approval. So whether that is requiring a sample purchase, whether that is doing a supplier audit, whether that is whatever it is, it's at your discretion. And you may decide that you're going to have multiple protocols for approving a supplier. You'll note that the requirement talks about not just approval, but monitoring and reevaluation. And obviously, it's also important to note that it does say retained documented information, which, of course, we've long since established that means records. The evaluation activities themselves need to be on the record. And I've had to have this discussion a couple of times. Having a supplier's name on a list is not evidence of evaluation, and it does not constitute a record of evaluation activity. You need to be prepared to show how were these suppliers, how were these external providers approved. That's key verbiage. Okay, so I wanted to take the time now to go over a couple of other key areas. Now, these are not necessarily rooted in nonconformances that are written, but these are more at this point, not so new. The standard is, after all, 6 years old at this point. But these were the items that stuck out as very new and very impactful when the 2015 version of the standard was published. Let's start with risk. Risk is a term that's used 16 times in the auditable portion of ISO 9001:2015. So you'll see the word risk 16 times in sections 4 through 10. Now, identification and management of risk, this is viewed as a system-wide strategy. If we've got anybody on the call today that remembers continual improvement being the new kid on the block when the 2000 version of the standard was published, same idea. You're not required to have a formal risk management process, but rather, you're required to incorporate what they call risk-based thinking. And the idea is risk aversion is something that's going to affect all of the various areas of your quality management system. ISO 9002, for its part, discusses key risks and says this may include the failure of processes, products, and services to meet requirements, or overall big picture, the organization not achieving customer satisfaction. That's the biggest risk of all, after all. There are two sub-clauses associated with risk. In clause 611, it indicates that when you're planning for the system, you need to consider the issues that are referred to in 4.1. This is a call out to those that come from both within and outside of the organization. And the requirements referred to in 4.2. This is a call out to internal and external interested parties. And therefore, determine the risks and opportunities. And I want you to note that both of those terms are used, risks and opportunities. Risks you can think of as preventing or reducing undesired effects, as we call out in subclause C. Opportunities you can think of as enhancing desirable effects, as we see in the call out subclause B here. And big picture, we want to give assurance that the system can achieve its intended results and improvement overall. So big picture items here. In 6.1.2, it goes on to say that you need to plan actions to address the risks and opportunities and how to implement those actions into your quality management system processes and then evaluate the effectiveness of those actions. Now, what do they mean by actions to address risks and opportunities? Well, again, ISO 9002 has got some good guidance for us. It says you can think of risk avoidance. You can just stop doing the process in question. You can think in terms of risk limitation, having procedures or work instructions to assist your team and therefore reduce the risk. You can think in terms of risk sharing. You can think, if raw material availability is an issue, maybe we can work with our customer and agree on bulk purchase in advance of the raw materials. Risk transfer. This could be things like maintaining insurance. And then finally, risk acceptance. When you've executed all reasonable measures, accepting the remaining residual risk. So how do we audit this concept? How do we audit this idea of risk management? We trained our auditors to ask an open-ended question and be prepared to examine the various activities that are presented by the auditee. Our primary expectation here is that the auditee should understand this concept, and they should be prepared to explain what the approach has been for that organization. Now, bear in mind, important thing to bear in mind, there is only one requirement in ISO 9001:2015 that mandates records pertaining to risk actions, and it relates to management review. The effectiveness of actions taken to address risks is one of the input topics for management review meetings, and of course, management review meetings are supposed to be on the record, as we prior discussed. Let's turn our attention now to interested parties. And let's start with the official definition for interested party. Interested parties are defined as person or organization that can affect, be affected by, or perceive themselves to be affected by a decision or activity. Now, the examples that are given in the official definition are going to include customers, owners, employees of the organization, suppliers, bankers, unions, partners, and competitors. Now, in clause 4.2, it indicates that the organization needs to determine who the interested parties are, but it emphasizes who are the interested parties that are relevant to the quality management system. So the idea here is you're going to make sure that your quality management system, when you've put it together, and as you are executing that system, that you're considering relevant input requirements. The idea with the term interested party, this was intended to kind of broaden the spectrum of where those requirements are going to come from. Now, one key point that we want to emphasize here is that it is most likely not appropriate for you to conclude that your only interested party group is your customer base. So we've trained our auditors that if the organization says just the customers, you need to be prepared to explain how you analyzed and concluded that customers were the only relevant interested party. So if you can't provide evidence of a structured analysis having been performed, it's likely that that process that you follow was flawed, and potentially a nonconformance may be issued. So who else might be an interested party? Well, we had a partial list just a few minutes ago. Here's an even more exhaustive list from ISO 9002 itself. And as you can see, this touches on a lot of different areas: governmental organizations, statutory regulatory authorities, unions, bankers, intellectual property owners, franchisors, and so forth. So the obvious item that we kind of wrestle with here is, well, okay, we've identified who our interested parties are. We think we know who they are. How do we know what they want? Well, again, we can turn to ISO 9002 and say, well, okay, how do you interact with these interested parties? And there's a good list that's provided. And I'm sure for many of you, these are things that you're already doing. Reviewing the orders that you're receiving. Reviewing statutory regulatory requirements, networking, benchmarking, doing market surveillance, user surveys, customer surveys, all sorts of ways to determine what the expectations are. Now, there are a couple of potential nonconformances associated with this concept of interested party. If we have no evidence or limited evidence that you're monitoring and reviewing information, that can potentially be cited under 4.2. And if we have no evidence or limited evidence of interested party feedback being discussed, that will represent a violation potentially of Management Review Clause 932C1. Now, as a final topic here, I want to touch on the concept of leadership. This is specifically mentioned in Section 5.1. So let's take a look at expectations. We've approached the concept of leadership in an open-ended fashion. And it was actually an interesting process as we were developing our new workbook for ISO 9001. We created an event that we refer to as the leadership interview. And our audit report directs that this be done at every audit. And we also have instructed our auditors to make sure that leadership is directly involved in the management of the quality system. So what goes on during the leadership interview? Well, we have a number of questions that we ask, and I've pulled these right out of our audit report. What are you specifically doing to make yourself accountable? How do you participate? Who are your interested parties? What are some things that you are dealing with right now, internal and external issues? Now, when we say leadership, and I do want to emphasize this as a key point, we do mean multiple people in most cases. You know, once in a while, we'll get a completed audit report and we'll see that only a single individual was included in the leadership interview. Now, in a small company, that's plausible, that's possible. But the larger the organization gets, the less believable it is that leadership is one person. ISO 9002 provides some interesting guidance on the role of top management. It says that certain authorities and responsibilities can be delegated, but accountability remains with top management. And there's a key takeaway point here. Some of you on our call today may remember what it was like to have a management representative, some person that was given the responsibility of managing the ISO 9001 system. You can certainly still appoint somebody to be the MR, as they're referred to, but understand that our auditors are going to be expecting to see that top management is accountable. Key point, key difference. Now, as I mentioned, in the context of an audit, especially an audit for an interpretive standard such as ISO 9001, it's going to be possible that we disagree. And how do we address things if we don't agree? If we've issued a nonconformance and the organization does not agree with one or more of the nonconformances that were issued. We do have a process that we provide for what we call a dispute. And this is actually provided in an official procedure, PGR Procedure Pro 10. Now, if you go to our homepage, go to the bottom of the homepage on pgr.com, look for something called Registration Document Download. You will find the Pro 10 among the items that can be downloaded. Now, bear in mind, if you've had an audit, you must file any disputes within 15 days, that's calendar days, of the end of the audit. After that, disputes cannot be filed. So in conclusion, the ISO 9001:2015 standard remains the world's most utilized management system standard. There are just over 880,000 registered companies worldwide. Many of the items that are cited are entirely avoidable, and they do seem to come up time and time again. It's our hope that you will find the content of this presentation leaving you feeling more confident that things are going to go well on audit day. If you're ready for a deeper dive, we do have a clause-by-clause primer course for For anyone that's new to ISO 9001 2015 and wants to have a better understanding in preparation for an audit or for some other purpose, that course is entitled ISO 9001 2015, a clause by clause analysis. It is 100% free, and you can find it on our website at pjr.com. I'd like to invite you to tune in for one of our other webinars. We have a special presentation on non-applicable clauses that kind of walks you through exemptions and what you should be doing in determining what can be exempted in your quality management system. We have a very popular presentation on interaction of processes, and it goes over how you should be defining your processes and determining their interface. And we've got webinars on a whole lot of other things, corrective action, stage one auditing, and many of the standards that we provide audit services for. If you'd like to be kept informed of the latest news automatically, the best way for you to do that is to go to our website at www.pjr.com. Go to the bottom of the page and enter your email address and click subscribe. You will be opted in for automatic updates on upcoming webinars, changes within the standards, and other points of information. I do thank you for your time. As an important reminder, copies of today's presentation will be available for download shortly after we're finished. And if you'd like to rewatch this webinar with the voiceover, it will be posted to our YouTube page shortly. And you can access both of those items on our website at www.pjr.com. As I said, I'm going to see if we have any questions. Let's go ahead and do that. Okay, we've got a few questions. I'll take these in the order they were presented. Francine Steininger, I do hope I'm pronouncing that right. Does ISO 9002 provide guidance on service industries as well, or mostly manufacturing? Francine, it is written from a very general perspective. A service-based company, I'm sure, would find benefit in reviewing it. Francine goes on to ask, how does traceability apply to a consulting firm that manages projects and provides expert advice? Francine, that's kind of a deep dive. I would prefer that you direct that question to one of our experts here at headquarters. That's a very structured answer. So I hope you'll forgive me for not answering that in this context. Please send us an email on that topic. Larry Musbach, hoping for a presentation of this nature for the ISO 13045 standard. Larry, I'll see who I can get to work on that. Thank you for the suggestion. Janice Guy asks, how do you audit the internal audit process? Well, Janice, there's a lot of ways to do that. You would need to come up with a potential approach and see how that goes on audit day. I can't really advocate a specific approach for you, but I can tell you there's a lot of ways to accomplish it. Lisa Stringham, do I suggest you remove your existing procedures from the system? Only if those procedures, Lisa, are no longer adding value to your system. Procedures are kind of a funny animal. I think some organizations feel great comfort in having them. It's nice to have a book of protocols and what to do. But if the procedures are woefully out of date with what you're actually doing, they can cause great harm on audit day. So if you're going to keep them up to date, keep them accurate. That's what I would say. Maria Aguilar. Interaction of processes is a common one. I believe you're referring to it is a common nonconformance. Quite right. We do have a presentation on that very topic, the interaction of processes and its importance to a successful audit. Nuria, I think that webinar would be great for you. Definitely encourage you to check out that webinar. Jacob Spangler, thank you for your suggestion and compliment as well. Any final questions? Okay, great. Everyone have a wonderful day. Thank you for your time.